Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRue Show for Saturday, July 12, 2014. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and we have two guests, medics from either side of the Atlantic, whom I'll introduce in just a moment. But our topic is long in its title, but speaks for itself. Physicians demand end the Obama-Tony Blair health care. Now, that means a euphemism for health care. It's Hitler-style health care. That is, we are seeing the mass threatening and extinction of life or the means to life through the euphemism called health care reform, and we're going to hear a lot about that. The second part of our program today is going to address the great prospects for medicine and for healthcare if we leave this killer paradigm behind us, put it behind us. We can have great advances ahead under a new system of world development of nations and peoples, and we'll be hearing about that. So I am going to begin by welcoming to the show the gentlemen are both on the telephone, one from beautiful northern Pennsylvania, Dr. Mark Shelley in Port Allegheny. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And I'm going to say just a word about him before we go to Germany for our guest in Berlin. But Dr. Shelley, who is a family physician, he can say more, who is practicing, and we're grateful that he took an hour off having to see people today. We are pre-taping. I'll throw that in on Friday, the 11th of July, due to schedule reasons. Dr. Shelley has been in family practice for, I think, over 20-some years, and I know he'd rather just be doing that and doing his farming that he likes to do in Pennsylvania, but in the last couple of years, he's had to put down his stethoscope sometimes and get very political. It was a year and a half ago he spoke in New York City at a transatlantic conference calling for a paradigm shift away from the dead monetarists kind of world system of globalization and the neo-British Empire, Wall Street and City of London. He spoke about the crisis conditions in the United States medical system where physicians can't do their doctoring and patients aren't getting care. And then within 6 months, in fall 2013, he issued a call, I think it was Physicians Against Murderous Obamacare, right, Dr. Shelley?
Yes, that's the name.
And people responded, other physicians, nurses, and general citizenry around our nation to this, and Dr. Shelley did visit Capitol Hill, seeing many offices there that some of them know the score and won't do anything. Others were shocked, putting the whole picture together, which we'll hear about. Now, I think Dr. Shelley will say he's talking about murderous Obamacare, but preceding that, even before Obama got in office, was a trend into what he called in his New York City speech the commoditization of healthcare, I believe. And people on LaRouchePub.com can find, by putting in Mark Shelley's name in the search, get these various articles and interviews. In Berlin, we're very glad to have on the phone with us Dr. Wolfgang Lilge. Welcome.
Yeah, welcome also. Thank you.
Good connection. And Dr. Lilge, likewise, is medically trained, born in Berlin, has done a lot in between living there, being born, and then coming back to it. But I'll just throw in, among many other things, he has, like Dr. Shelley, taken a very active concern about the undermining of society, what's happening in Europe today in the way of threats to life, in the takedown of the healthcare system. And over the decades, Dr. Lilge has literally, I think the last time you were on the show, you were running for office in Berlin, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
And in order to put forth a policy alternative to this dead system that's now killing people. And I think you may have been with Helga Zepp LaRouche, Mr. Lyndon LaRouche's wife, a founding member or officer of the political party in Germany, right?
That's right, yeah, the Büsow Party, yes.
And that's the, in English, it's the Civil Rights Solidarity.
Yeah, right. Bürgerrechtsbewegung Solidarität. And I actually was also a candidate in the recent European elections, which we had in Germany.
Oh, okay. So you see the platform in which Dr. Lilja has been active. And so we'll get, I just want to update listeners on very briefly on one aspect of things. Also, Dr. Lilja is going to, before the program is out, particularly talk about some of the exciting prospects in science. If we didn't have this green life has to be ended, resources are all used up approach to the world of this, that's a test tube concoction belief structure by, as I called it, the neo-British Empire. If we didn't have that, what we could be doing. But what I want to tell people, again, this is our show for July 12, is the fantastic kind of opportunity we have in the world and some events in Washington, D.C., since the 10-day July 4th Independence Day break, when congressmen went to their home districts and got bombarded, that the Congress came back, and their first day on July 9th, full day of action, the impeachment of Obama, literally the I word, was literally on people's lips. I'm using my English usage properly. I mean, the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, on July 9th was confronted by reporters, why aren't you doing impeachment? Why are you filing a lawsuit against President Obama's infractions in office? Then July 10th, reporters ganged up on him again, and at a 12-minute press conference, four of the questions were on impeachment. This is just the tip of the iceberg of the sentiment that, thanks to the huge, intense mobilization of activists of all kinds it's spearheaded by the LaRouche Political Action Committee, that has changed the situation here in the United States for the potential of breaking with the dying British Empire monetarist system. And it comes about as the line has been drawn internationally by the nation of Argentina standing up to a completely illegal, corrupt decision by federal banks in the U.S. saying Argentina owes money to a bunch of bums, a bunch of speculative scavenger Wall Street, City of London, vulture funds they're called, that bought some, for pennies on the dollar, some Argentine sovereign debt years ago that from holders who refused to go along with a decent restructuring that the nation of Argentina made good on with some other debt holders. And this group, connected to a man named Paul Singer, it has MNL, it has different names. This group was given the okay by the U.S. federal courts in recent weeks that Argentina has to pay them. Complete blood money. Argentina doesn't have to pay them. The nation of Argentina is making that clear and not backing down, and they now have the backing explicitly of institutions around the world, such as the Organization of American States. All of them except the United States and Canada agree Argentina shouldn't pay. The group of 77 nations that met in New York City think likewise. Other institutions in South America, one called Mercosur. So even in Italy, there in Europe, I think Italy is the first one where the ruling political party of Italy, I think it's called the Democracy Party, they have a nonpartisan petition as a party they are circulating beginning this past week saying Argentina should be supported. And we just had a LaRouche show on this. We'll have more. So that's not our topic today, but look at the place we are in history. In the way of there's only one side or the other, the side of humanity, which is what formed our American system economy and our republic here in the United States. And with the opportunity to make a break with the vulture funds echelon of the Wall Street, City of London axis by the impeachment, initiating the impeachment of Obama, then it's completely wide open for us to put in national interest emergency measures such as get the Glass-Steagall Act reinstated to cut off this speculative to cut off that cancer, I'll use a medical term, and start to get healthy again, and take other necessary measures for national interest banking, needed projects, including the medical field of infrastructure, soft and hard infrastructure, and go for high energy nuclear, the nuclear era, which certainly can mean a lot for basic biology and biophysics research. So one more thing on that, and then we'll turn to our guests. I want you to note that another bombshell is on July 9th there in Congress, when everyone was talking about impeaching Obama. A loose grouping of organizations delivered 600,000 petition signatures for Congress to reinstate the Glass-Steagall Act, the 21st Century Glass-Steagall Act that Senator Elizabeth Warren and other senators back. Well, this grouping, which includes such things as the AFL-CIO or I think Public Citizen, the whole host of, they hoped a year or two ago they could gather 100,000 signatures. Well, with no time, in no time at all, and with no trouble, it was 600,000. The time is ripe. This is our time, but we want to go like crazy, and that's where we have the, in my personal view, the grounds for hope to otherwise look at a miserable situation of suffering and lives being lost, and in particular the people dying on the killing fields now in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, Libya. You have a dark age operation underway because of the continuation of this this dead British, neo-British Empire kind of playing each against all, but it can be vanquished. So with that as the background, what I'd like to do is, Wolfgang Lilge, will you start with giving us an update on the European picture in terms of what you're up against with austerity, and certainly if you want to go with what we could have instead, but how bad it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks. Yes, of course. I may start my report, my short report, by stating that basically all European nations right now are victim of the dictatorial policies of the European Union, which is, as an institution, really the instrument of the financial empire of the City of London. And the situation for them has become so desperate, actually, for this empire structure to hold together its system, that it literally demands its pound of flesh from its debtors, and as Shakespeare demonstrated that in The Merchant of Venice. And the most obvious case for that policy in Europe is, of course, Greece, which has been turned, where the European Union has turned a debt crisis, which Greece suffered, into a humanitarian catastrophe. In 2008, Greece was forced to accept a bailout for its failing banks, and the 200 million bailout, which has gone there, was used exclusively went exclusively to the banks to pay off creditors, and in the process created an ever-expanding new debt. So the Greek government, under this dictate of the Troika, of European Central Bank, IMF, and the EU Commission, started a massive austerity program, which is, was really unparalleled in any other nation. And the result was a mass murder, basically, occurring in Greece in a very literal sense. As the ones most hit were old people, children, and the poor. Hundreds of thousands of people lost their jobs. Salaries were slashed, and especially the healthcare system was taken down. In a recent article, actually beginning of the year, the British medical journal Lancet had published a study which where it was reported that the Greek government and the Troika massively understated the catastrophic consequences of their policy. I may quote a little bit out of that report in Lancet and give some figures of what is going on in Greece. Unprecedented death rates have been accomplished, according to Lancet, through savage cuts and funding of healthcare. The report showed how uninsured cancer patients, for example, are left to pay for their own life-saving treatments as a result of losing their Social Security coverage. It reports also that the healthcare budget was cut by 25% since 2009, and the number of uninsured has increased from 500,000 in 2008 to at least 2.3 million today. Greece now spends less on healthcare than any of the EU member states in 2004. For example, the public hospital budget was cut by 26% between 2009 and 2011. In the last 2 years, it has been cut even more. The budget for medicines was slashed from 4.7 billion in 2010 to 2.88 billion in 2012 and then to 2 billion for 2014. Doctors at the country's hospitals have not been paid for 6 months, prompting strikes throughout the hospital system. Another example is mental health care, which has been savagely cut. Funding for the sector was cut 20% between 2010 and 2011 and by a further 55% between 2011 and 2012. Cases of depression because of the unbearable situation have risen by 250%, suicides by 45% between 2007 and 2011. Cuts in mosquito spraying have led to the resurgence of malaria, which was virtually wiped out 40 years ago. There could be many more details. Actually, one very telling example is that the death toll during the last year's flu season was increasing massively. At least 110 people have died of influenza in only a couple of weeks, the highest rate in Europe. As it was admitted by the Greek government, it has not purchased enough flu vaccine and did not conduct an annual flu vaccination campaign for the most vulnerable. And that is probably the most criminal action which can be thought of, because a flu shot only costs €6 or dollars each for each shot. So these are some typical aspects of what is going on and how the destruction of the health system has been going on. Actually, more than 2 million people in Greece now have no health insurance. There's a mass exodus of young population, also professionals especially. The last 3 years from Athens alone, 6,500 doctors left the country and went to Germany alone, or to Sweden or other European countries. But that is probably only really the tip of the iceberg, because in the rest of Europe, the situation is in the healthcare sector is not much better, especially in the southern European nations, as Cyprus, which was the model country for the first bail-in for saving the banking system, then Italy, Spain, and Portugal. Actually, the medical association of Portugal, Greece, Spain, and Ireland had, beginning of this year, issued an open letter to political leaders and health authorities of Europe, denouncing the disastrous effects imposed on them by the austerity policies of the Troika. And in Portugal also, thousands of doctors, actually only this week, went into strike in protest against the austerity program of the government. And the only ones who praise Portugal for these kind of measures are the rating agencies and other banking associations. For example, Moody's upgraded Portugal's state bonds in November of 2013 and said Portugal is a success story. How cynical can one be when even the severely sick are denied effective treatment? I can also say something about the German situation, but maybe we should have either some discussion or questions on that general situation in Europe.
That's very stark. Dr. Shelley, do you want to draw out anything in particular or point to anything? It must seem similar to you.
I think Maybe what's even more troubling is that in the United States, we're told that we have health care and we're told that we have insurance. We're told that everything is very good, when it's exactly the opposite. So people, the average person is comfortable because he's sure that he's that everything is okay. But it's almost cruel to the paradoxical way that this is presented. You see the Affordable Care Act, which is, a patient in the office yesterday said, well, it looks like I may reach my deductible, the money that he pays before the insurance
works. Okay.
Because he's having eye surgery, he has a corneal dystrophy, and he's blind, and he's legally blind, but he has a big farm. Mm-hmm. But he really, really wants to work. I said, what is your deductible? He said, $10,000. So from milking his cows, he has to get $10,000 before he can, plus I think he said it's another $8,000 for the premium that he pays each year.
Mm-hmm.
So point being, this is not the Affordable Care Act, nor is it the Patient Protection Act. It's the exact opposite of protecting these patients.
Mm-hmm.
And it works for many, many, many. It's death by a thousand bites. It's from many directions. It's from the regulations in the hospitals. It's the regulations in the pharmaceutical industries, the insurance companies. I had on my desk yesterday a special bulletin for professional providers. Attention physicians, an insurance company will add 12 drugs to pharmacy prior authorization program for Medicare Advantage members.
Let me just interpose, because Wolfgang, I'm sure you know, but the meaning you prior authorization, you or your office has to call the insurance authorities before you dare do what you want to do?
Well, it's an interesting.
Okay.
Prior authorization, I have to, first be authorized to get, until recently, testing, but now it's testing, it's medications. And this is one of the most insidious forms of rationing, because, for example, a patient comes to my office and has a history, exam, and all findings consistent with a torn meniscus in their knee. So they should have an MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, which the insurance companies generally say has to have a prior authorization. I'll spend a few minutes with the patient, understand the problem, explain to them the problem, and order a test. The form for the test will go to my staff, who, when they have a chance, take it upstairs and go online, or if they phone, they'll phone and maybe be on hold. But now mostly it's done online, and they type in a request for this study, and 48 hours later we get a response that either we can have the study, which usually doesn't happen, but they ask for more information. I then send to the insurance company other testing notes, lab work, a good bit of the chart, which goes back to the insurance company, and then in another 48 hours, we hear whether they agree to pay for the test or not. Now, a friend of mine without insurance was in this position, and the test was refused. And he said, I'll pay cash to the radiologist, and they said, you can't pay cash. He said, I have it right now. And they said, it's illegal for us to do a test for cash if the patient has insurance. But now the insurance has denied that he can have the test, and it's for, because it's not medically indicated. That's their out. So the patient couldn't have the test. If nothing else, the resources that have been used up by this process, these are resources. This is thought, energy, and time that from a nurse or a physician that should be spent on solving medical problems and helping people, but instead is spent interacting with a computer. And then the study's denied. All right, I'm sorry.
No, you mentioned... No, that now makes it worse than clear. But
yeah.
But you said you have 12 prior authorizations. Is this drugs now, not just those tests?
No. These are effective September 14th. This unnamed insurance company will add 12 drugs to their pharmacy prior authorization program. And it's... there are 12 different drugs and or medications, one of which is rabies vaccine.
Oh, my word.
Okay, so now if my patient is bitten by a rabid animal and comes to the office with a certainly fatal disease, I have to say, well, let's think about this.
And of course, you're in the country with raccoons, bats, and everything else.
Oh, absolutely. Raccoons, bats. We've had rabies from cattle.
If
cattle that were bitten by bats, there are a lot of rabies here. Mostly raccoons, skunks, bats are a lot of rabies and bats. But anyway, the patient knows they will die without this. And they're told, let's think about it. We'll decide whether or not you can have this. Because remember, again, it's the uncertainty. It's the uncertainty that unravels your brain. It's the uncertainty of maybe it's illegal for them to get to pay cash for this vaccine. Maybe they'll have to get it on the black market because it was illegal for Henry to have the MRI to pay cash for it, and he was refused that by his insurance company. So this is the Patient Protection Act in action.
Right. Well, let me ask you, Wolfgang, because I know Dr. Shelley has more aspects of what he's describing is describing the entire system of the U.S. where, even in dollar terms, less is now being spent. The Obama administration is claiming this as a success. There's less health care being given. Well, now you can imagine why. Less hospitalization, fewer procedures. But do you want to say something about Germany right now, Wolfgang?
Yeah, sure. I mean, what Mark is reporting really is very, very sick. I mean, the system is so anti-human. And that comparison, probably in Germany, we are still in paradise somehow, but this is really only probably the first glance. Otherwise, I can say the system in Germany, the healthcare system in Germany, is very, very much underfunded, and it actually is working on the edge of bankruptcy and insolvency, which is actually very, very paradoxical because on the one side, the German state budget right now, which is has been played up in the press very much. Is basically balanced, so there's no need for further new credits to finance the budget and so forth. But on the other hand, you see the German clinics have not enough resources for investment because the profitability is so low. So there's an investment bottleneck of at least 15 billion euros. In Germany for clinical investments, for expansion investment of machines and so forth. And actually more than 250 clinics, which has been coming out in a recent report, are threatened with bankruptcy. These are 13% of all German clinics, and the most affected by that are actually mainly small clinics in the countryside, where people have to go a long ways to the next clinic anyway, and if some of these are closing down, then the situation is really very, very hopeless. And the main motor behind this very bad financial situation of the German hospitals is the introduction of this infamous diagnosis-related group system, the DLG system, which has been introduced in Germany in 2003, where hospitals are paid by the insurance system only according to a fixed amount of money for each patient's diagnosis, independent of the length of stay. So the hospital management is interested in having only uncomplicated cases, patients, which are treated and dismissed in a very short time to make some profit. Complicated cases are not welcome. And if you look at it more concretely, this DLG system is a massive austerity program because the rates for these diagnoses are calculated in such a way that a reasonable treatment is not possible anymore. And now this process of austerity is coming to an end. Actually, the so-called rationalization efforts don't work anymore. They are exhausted. And now the system says, okay, if you can't compete anymore, these clinics are removed from the market. That is the effect that actually a lot of these small clinics are about to disappear. Actually, already probably next year there will be a massive cycle of bankruptcy going on. These are mainly communal or church-owned clinics, small ones, probably less than 100 beds. And some of them are taken over by private clinic chains now in Germany with a private management, which means even more austerity for doctors, nurses, and patients. that is really the obvious dilemma in Germany, because really if there would be a policy to support healthcare system, there would be much, much, much more money into the system, which is really very obvious to anybody who is in Germany needed and does need treatment. Another aspect is actually the side aspect of that is that there's a shortage of doctors upcoming. So there are a lot of older doctors are retiring. And there's not enough younger colleagues coming to replace them. So actually, the result of this austerity program is that the working conditions in hospitals are so bad that actually young doctors who actually want to make a career they think twice about it. And they don't start a practice, they don't go into a clinic, but looking for another job possibility. So there's a more and more discrepancy between older doctors retiring and less younger doctors coming after them, which is already now reflected in the very bad, very, very long waiting times for patients to see specialists, even in bigger cities. For example, for an appointment for an eye doctor may last for half a year or so.
Wow.
which is intolerable, and that is a direct reflection of the policy of austerity, which is so completely dominant in German politics. So that may be also the situation in many other countries in Europe also.
I think. And as we talk about this austerity and this lack of resources, when in the U.S. it's 17-18% of the GDP, they're trillions and trillions of dollars, and I suspect that there's a similar amount, maybe half as much a percentage of GDP in Germany. But
you mean for healthcare expenditures nominally? You mean
for yeah. healthcare?
Yeah.
Quote,
mm-hmm.
Because obviously we're not delivering care, We're not helping people. We're not giving them health care. So where did the money go?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that is the question. And that is the question, as Wolfgang says. It's in Germany, it's in the U.S., and probably throughout the rest of the world. Where is the money going?
Mm-hmm.
Why are there not resources? Now, granted, I think for my colleagues here in the States, there's just a generalized angst and an unease, a discomfort with the practice of medicine, because we feel that, because it's so, we just struggle to do what was once so easy. And it's for many reasons. Let's say the prior authorizations are new. The electronic medical record, which is held up as, which has been just pushed, such a helpful, wonderful thing, has cut productivity by anywhere from 25 to as much as 50%.
Could you explain more in the sense that it has to do with a lot of this coding, right?
Well, actually, the electronic medical record is a parallel of the coding.
Okay.
Again, it's your diagnosis is now a number, mm-hmm. just as you are a number. It's the dehumanization, the monetization, making it's profaning the sacred. It's taking human life and giving it numbers. The coding is necessary. Every diagnosis must have a code in order to be filed with the insurance company. And it's the ICD-9, which was to have ended last year, and we started with the ICD-10. Remember, every diagnosis, everything I do has to have a code. And with the ICD-9, we had 40,000 codes.
Oh, my watch.
Yeah, but the ICD-10 has 110,000.
Oh, no, is this insurance, standard insurance coding? Is that what you're telling us?
It's insurance coding. It's
okay.
If the patient is to have a test done, if the patient is to have a prescription, it's unavoidable
mm-hmm.
that they have to have this code. The physician must assign a code to what he did. If I amputate a toe, okay, there's a code for the great toe, there's a code for the second, third, fourth, and fifth toe, there's a code for where the toe is amputated, there's a code for if the patient was diabetic, there's a code for, and I'm rambling a bit here because I've never really done these so much. I write the diagnosis and my staff looks it up. Again, the patient is paying for this to be done. In the hospitals, I've remained independent, but in the hospitals, the physicians are now required to do all their own coding. So there's a 40,000 different numbers that you have to choose from to decide what it is you did. If you put down the wrong number or you put the decimal point incorrectly, then it's fraud.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So, but the ICD-10... with over 100,000, somewhere over 100,000 codes that I have to choose from. I have to scroll through, so to speak, for my encounter, includes, this ICD-10 includes a code for injuries from a burning surfboard.
Oh, no.
No, it's like somebody decided to make a joke of this. There are codes for parrot bites. It's making a mockery of what we do,
mm-hmm.
and as well as making it impossible to do what we do. So,
speaking,
I think,
let me ask you of physicians, as Wolfgang has said about the shortage, the forced into. There's going to be more forcing into austerity of nurses and physicians, but Dr. Shelley, you've often pointed out that decades ago, you would think of a family physician or even a specialist and others having independent practices, either partnerships or alone. But all of that is now there's a higher and higher percentage where you are working for a hospital chain or some equivalent and you are told what to do, not just how to code, but everything, right?
Right. Well, that's in order they're making it less and less possible to practice medicine without an electronic medical record, and those systems can cost upwards of $100,000. So if it's just one doc, you know, he takes an entire year's salary to put a system in place that will reduce his productivity by 25% or 30% henceforth. Now, remember, electronic medical records are, there are 1,600 of them in this country. None of them communicate with each other. So when I get a patient from, when the patient goes from one hospital to another across town, there's no way to send the records. The records come in an envelope with a kilogram of paper in it. And that's the, and somewhere buried in there is the patient's diagnosis and their med list and what happened to them. So that's one of the ways that the electronic medical record has damaged healthcare, is that there's much, much, much less communication. There's virtually no physician-to-physician communication because they rely on the electronic medical record to, quote, have everything, unquote. Yes, it has many, many needles and many, many haystacks is what happens. And so I receive patients in the nursing home, maybe with a tracheostomy, maybe with a feeding tube, and they've had a six-month hospitalization. They will arrive at the nursing home for me to take care of. I have no idea where they've been, what they're doing, what happened. The physician doesn't talk to me because that's more or less been lost now. And I have 2 inches thick of papers to read through that contain things like documentation of each day for 3 months when the patient received each drug. And it's extremely difficult to find even the diagnosis. So that's the picture. These are frustrations for why physicians my age are retiring, even though they have 10, 20 years of productive practice.
Yes, this is.
You have the prior authorizations, electronic medical records. You have this lack of resources, similar to what's described in Germany.
Yes, I wonder. You have, just to make clear. Someone's been lost. Are you still there, Dr. Shelley?
I am.
Okay. Well, I'm sure George, our technical person, will reconnect.
Okay.
But while we can, one thing stuck out in my mind from what both of you are saying is, we are losing hospitals across the United States, especially in rural areas, and diagnostic facilities. For example, just getting a mammogram now is not automatic in many high plains Midwestern counties. We don't have the diagnostics per 1,000 people that we did even a few years ago. You may or may not be seeing it exactly, anyone listening, where you are, but it's the case. If you want to have certain kinds of things done, you might have to drive 5 counties if you're out in the high plains of Nebraska or Western Kansas.
Yes, that's true. Trying to solve the problem. You know, Wolfgang explains, you know, the austerity in Greece. He explains the problems, the bankruptcy of clinics in Germany, and you know, we experience in the United States this promise of affordable and protection and consistent and predictable and better. When actually the only reason they say those words is to so it takes longer to figure out that it's the opposite.
Yeah.
But at the same time that there are this absolute deluge of money that is supposedly for healthcare.
Yeah. But
the actual delivery of healthcare doesn't happen. I mean, where did the money go? I don't have that answer. I have some ideas. I think we I think every one of us needs to ask that question, who got the money?
Right, and one thing we'll make clear, who was in on in England in 1999 in the so-called Tony Blair healthcare reform, a man named Simon Stevens, who then came to the U.S., the big cartels of Wall Street insurance company, that wing of insurance companies, the United Healthcare is the biggest insurer in the U.S., there are other famous names, who once were part of an American economy which worked, like Aetna,
right.
Years ago.
Right.
So we're not just blaming across the board, but there is the guaranteed profits for this echelon that are to come out of the hospitals, the Medicare fees, the Medicaid fees, and that's outstanding. What I want to ask is Dr. Lilge back on? Are you there, Wolfgang?
Yes, I am back, yes.
Okay, good. If it's okay, Mark, we do have a remaining segment. What you just raised, Mark, about the fraud of the Affordable Care and Patient Protection Act verbiage, and Tony Blair used that in 1999 in England, similar verbiage, okay?
I'm sure it's been used by some pretty unsavory characters.
Yeah, I think Hitler
time.
In 1939 used it by saying, we'll save resources for the state by culling lives not worthy to continue. But the thing is that brings us back again. We have the opportunity. We break this in the United States. We can file this impeachment of the proxy for all this stuff, Barack Obama, and move ahead. And Wolfgang, do you want to say some of what you've been thinking about with the exciting lines of research that we ought to be undertaking and fully funding?
Yeah, actually, we are basically on the next step. It was very close to go into a completely new system where the research and new knowledge which we have about processes of life and so forth can be implemented. We just need to go to the construction of the world land bridge, which must be based on fusion power, which must be based on developments which condense energy in a form which is unprecedented so far, and we are talking about fusion energy, which we are talking about plasmas, which are normally to achieve fusion power. They are hundreds and 200 million degrees hot. But now plasma research has been advanced in a way that we actually can produce also so-called cold plasmas, which is an ionized gas, so it's an ion which has been got rid of all the electrons and which is positively charged, but can be produced through strong electric fields and so forth, with degrees of only room temperature or body temperature at least below 100 degrees Celsius, which is very much a new aspect of for treatment of cancer patients, for example, but also can be used for sterilization, which is a very important factor given the situation of the resistant strains of bacteria, which cannot be treated with regular antibiotics anymore. So there have been experiments and also already usages for applying these cold plasmas for sterilization, but also, which is very interesting, which has been reported recently only to use these kind of cold plasmas to treat cancer, which is somehow a phenomenon which is striking, that a cancer cell which is hit by this cold plasma is actually driven into a cell death. And at the same time, the so-called normal cells in the environment are not affected by that. So it may be very selective, which is another avenue of cancer treatment, which actually also the laser treatment has been opening up recently, which can be focused selectively in a way that only the cancer cell is dying and not the surrounding tissue. So that may be advanced even further when we actually go into such a fusion-based economy, which is a very, very optimistic approach. Another aspect which I've been working with in the recent time is the field of space medicine, which is started with manned space flights, where people have been prepared, astronauts have been prepared to survive in a very adverse condition of in space. And they have to be monitored. They have been. They have to be checked that everything is all right. And investments into that part of medicine has actually resulted also in many usages of medical treatments on Earth. So it's an earthly effect which is coming out of space medicine, which is very promising. I actually want to only name one example, which the time allows now, which is the treatment of osteoporosis, which is a very widespread condition. I think in Germany we have at least 5 million people suffering from that. The possibility for treating that has been developed in respect to the problem that astronauts in space and in weightlessness are losing a lot of calcium. The muscles are destroyed or at least reduced very much because of the weightlessness, and that process has not been is not actually stopping after even longer visits in space. A group of scientists in Berlin at the Charité Hospital here, they actually made experiments with with a new device which actually is causing a kind of very specific vibration, and where the test persons are put on that board. And through the specific vibration which this board is producing, the muscles are so much stimulated that actually the muscle destruction is ended and actually turned into the opposite. And that could be definitely applied for longer space flights, which would then prohibit that the calcium loss and also the muscle loss is continuing. But at the same time, obviously, this could be also used for osteoporosis patients on Earth, that actually the loss of bone structure and so forth stopped. So that is just another example. There are many more examples which could be mentioned, but I actually can only refer to an article which I wrote about this the space medicine subject, which appeared in the German Fusion magazine, which I'm also the editor of.
Okay.
It's actually also creating this kind of optimistic approach to overcome new frontiers and enter into a completely new phase of research and understanding of human beings.
Go ahead, Mark. That's exciting.
It is very exciting, and it's, as you say, it's optimistic, but it's absolutely real, and it's the reality that we once had. When I speak about the lost energy, the frustrations, the three steps forward, two and three quarters back, of these prior authorizations, of the coding, the records being destroyed through this electronic medical records, the decisions regarding health care being made by untrained, unskilled, self-interested managers. It's easy to get sort of lost in that and to be lost in the emotion of it because it is so appalling. But the purpose, the reason that's appalling is that this is wonderful, beautiful, powerful human energy that could be going into this research, that could be going into so many good things, and it's being squandered. It's being lost. The reason healthcare is expensive is because it's inefficient, because it's ineffective. We are not delivering healthcare, even though we're spending so much money on it, because it's inefficient. It's ineffective. It has an internal problem, and we desperately need healthcare reform. We don't need health insurance reform. We need healthcare reform, which would include removing the people who are running it now. These decisions are not to be made by a politician. They're not to be made by an insurance agent. They're not to be made by a stockbroker. If they're to be made right, of course it's inefficient. Of course it's expensive. Of course it's ineffective. If I ran an ice cream factory, it would be all of the above, because I don't know how to do that. I shouldn't be expected to do that. I shouldn't be allowed to do that.
And one thing that really impresses me is, Wolfgang, here in the United States, Mark could tell you more about it, but there is a wave of cutting back on the ability to have universal testing or scanning or the public health system checking for different kinds of cancers. The states have ceased checking for tuberculosis. The state of Virginia, I'll give one example. If you taught school here, you used to have every year or two be required to get a tuberculosis test. They eliminated that for reasons of money. They've ceased doing certain kinds of universal vaccinations. You have resurgence of different childhood diseases and so forth, because part underneath, besides saying, oh, it's too much money, is the idea we're not going to cure them and don't want the people anyway, because we're not going for just the kind of new and exciting frontier treatments that, Wolfgang, you just discussed, you see. So do you notice that at all, Mark, in the sense of less scanning, less universal, used to be in the 1950s, and before we found the polio vaccine, for example, it was just presumed, as you said, it's the reality that we once had. Is there a new disease? Let's find out who all has it, find everybody, try and fend it off and defeat it.
Yes, I mean, that's how we once lived as a society, and no, we don't see that now.
You're not in a big city, so you may not see walking into your doctor's office certain kinds of the things I just described, but of course they are, you know, as you know, from your national overview.
Yes, I did. I lived in cities for a long time.
Oh, yeah, in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. There's almost a, I mean, I don't know who's doing this or why. I think those who study the politics more than I would be able, but I think probably I see more intimately, and I feel it, and you know, in my heart and guts when I see these people suffer and die because somebody somewhere took the money. And somebody somewhere was dishonest about what they were doing for you, and when a patient is harmed or a patient dies, they do it individually, and when that happens, they're either gone, or their family is grieving, and there's usually not much happens to find out why and if and what could have been done, should have been done. And I do think that we tend to not worry about health care until we're sick, and then after we're sick, we're not able to do anything about it. And if we could engage people to be concerned about this and to extrapolate it to, you know, what could be done with this human energy, be it money or time or clear thinking. I mean, an incredible parasitism on healthcare is the uncertainty. Maybe, I don't know, 1,000 different insurance companies that represent, you know, that are active in Pennsylvania, and each one of them makes their own rules and then changes them once a month. So I can't know what's allowed or what isn't by the insurance company. And why should the insurance company allow, like you would allow a child? You know, I mean, who's in charge? But...
Well, I think what you're both saying, we've run out of time, is you're describing a situation that's a call to action, isn't it? It speaks for itself that you formed Physicians Against Murderous Obamacare.
Yeah.
And in the closing minutes, or seconds, I guess, but Wolfgang, do you want to say amen to that or anything special for our listeners on this side?
Yeah, I think which sums up the situation very much is that many people, even in the health sector, don't see the connection between the financial crisis, the collapse of the economy, and the crisis in the healthcare system. That is, I think, is a very, very important aspect of actually making clear that there is a direct effect of speculation, of hedge funds going crazy, and the collapse of the health system. Because of the financing is one thing, but if you apply austerity programs actually to feed those vulture funds and speculators, then you have the effect exactly of what Mark was describing. If you have these six stupid diagnosis-related groups, and that is the same situation in Germany with this crazy coding system and so forth, which takes a lot of time and resources out of every doctor dealing with that. And the trick is that with all these codes, there's a price connected to it. And this price is the manipulation of the whole system, because this can be move down and down and down ever more, and then you have exactly the effects which that there is seemingly no money available in the system anymore, and all these reforms, all these completely destructive systems, they have to be eliminated. All the reforms have been, which also in Germany are going on since the 80s and even before, that they must be returned, that they must be eliminated. And going back to the same, to the old system of actually putting people first, that when people are sick, they have to be treated without regard to any cost consideration in the first place. And that is then opening up a whole new optimism also in the healthcare system itself.
Well, I have to thank both of you, and I know, just because the time has run out, Mark, you've reiterated many times in the last year that the Hippocratic Oath should be resumed, right?
Absolutely.
And go ahead, in your final, go ahead.
If we could, you know, return to principle. We need to return to principle. Some things are sacred. They're not all material. And Wolfgang was saying, you know, again, coming back to the issue of money, it's not the fact that the money was stolen doesn't mean that people will do without a new iPhone. It means that they'll do without their health or maybe their lives. And we have to stop wasting the money, because we're wasting life. We're wasting in every in every way, in every sense of the word.
Well, thank you both very much, Dr. Wolfgang Lilge in Berlin, Dr. Mark Shelley in Northern Pennsylvania, and we look forward to having you again soon. This is July 12, 2014, Marcia Mary Baker signing off. Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good day.